Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm back this week as one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. And with me, as always, and even here when I'm not here, is Thomas Brooks.
I never leave.
And
I'm
Alyssa
trapped
Jones.
In the Zoom box.
And Alyssa Jones.
Hi, everybody.
So we're delving back into memory. It's 3 weeks of memory. And week two of memory, we're moving into something that I think everyone's interested in to some degree. When we think of memory, this is probably one of those big topics that tends to pop up outside of maybe like memory in the courtroom. And we're going to be talking about amnesia. So
basic. Wait, what are we talking about?
Exactly. That would be an example of one of the types of amnesia where you can't remember new information. The most typical type that we tend to talk about, or at least when people refer to amnesia, is that they forget past events. And regardless, amnesia involves the loss of memory in some way. And so either someone losing memories that they once had, and this is also a little different than things like repression, where the memory's there, but the person is forcing activation to not happen. Or it involves some impairment with people's ability to remember or retain new information. There are a lot. There are a number of different illnesses, cognitive disorders, variety of things that can cause this. Like the one that always comes to mind with me is Korsakoff's syndrome, which is I think it's a vitamin K deficiency. Is it vitamin K or is it vitamin B? It might be K. And essentially what happens in this case is it blocks your ability to form and retrieve new schemas or new schematic information. And so you don't have your old schemas to fall back on or these old, you know, shortcuts, and you can't form new ones. Though that one, by upping your vitamin deficiency, you look it up?
I looked it up. Korsakoff's usually results from a deficiency of vitamin B1, which may be caused by alcohol abuse, dietary deficiencies, prolonged vomiting, eating disorders, or the effects of chemotherapy.
And you fix it by giving someone B1, and it can help restore some of those lost aspects. But yeah, there are a number of those, you know, important vitamins.
Ask it'll... your doctor if B1 is right for you.
We have these two types of amnesia, retrograde amnesia and anterograde amnesia. Anterograde being kind of this inability to form new memories. We talked about some of that pretty extensively when we discussed Memento.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
With Dr. Plante. And that's probably the most famous, I don't want to say case. I mean, I'm saying it's at least in the consciousness to some degree. Like when, I don't think it's
first
the most
dates.
That's true. It's true. And is that, did we talk about how good 50 First Dates was with like its portrayal?
Mm-hmm. No, I really appreciate that movie as compared to, actually, we probably hashed this out in the podcast,
yes,
but this idea of community around someone with mental health issues.
Yeah, one of the things that, when I talk about the other side, which I'm going to talk about today, retrograde amnesia, at least for a little bit, one of the things, like, there aren't a whole lot of good movies that do retrograde amnesia justice. It's usually bad soap operas, or it's a movie that plays off retrograde amnesia, like parts of memory, but it's not really retrograde amnesia. Like the one that I always think about is The Majestic with Jim Carrey. So he has this like complete loss of memory about his past life, and it happens due to like a car accident. Except that what it seems to be, if you really wanted to break the literature down, is it's probably dissociative fugue. Because he's in the movie, he's tied up with, we should watch that. We'll add that to our next movie list. He's tied up with the McCarthy trials. He's a filmmaker. Ooh. And he's really stressed out because like he's about to get blacklisted, or he's just getting blacklisted. And while driving, like has this accident. I'm like, they don't need him to have the accident. He can have a dissociative fugue state due to the stress and just show up in this town not remembering who he is. It would be completely realistic. And they're like, no, he has to fall off of a bridge and survive in his car. and look exactly like this other guy from town. It's very unrealistic.
What movie is this?
The Majestic.
The Majestic. I have not seen it.
It's good. I mean, it's an enjoyable movie. It's Jim Carrey during his very like serious movies phase. Mm. It's definitely not a comedy, but yeah, I mean, I'd recommend it as a movie, but
yeah, I'll put it on my list.
So, what I learned about retrograde amnesia, so forgetting information, this is the definition from the National Institute of Health, the loss of access of memories that were previously encoded. So basically stuff that was there prior. It's most commonly preceded by trauma, including physical injury, stroke, or seizure, but may also be psychogenic in origin. So you can definitely have these dissociative states or these like severe psychological trauma that may cause memory loss. It may be temporary or permanent. So they leave it very open into how prolonged this is. But the ability to encode new memories or skills is not generally affected. And so they typically do separate retrograde and anterograde amnesia in the medical literature, typically.
Mm-hmm. That's usually how we cover it in courses, too. Like yes. If you're taking a COG class, like you're going to talk about retrograde and then anterograde amnesia in separate discussions.
Right. It was interesting, though. I did find some articles that seems to link the two, or at least that while the presence of, let's say, one may not include the other, the presence of that one may include the other. I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, if you have anterograde and retrograde tend to occur together in the same pattern, and that's been something pretty long established. But I'll kind of get to that.
Okay.
So it is interesting. The literature on this actually goes back a little over 100 years. It goes back to a researcher named Ribot, R-I-B-O-T, in 1881. Some of the first actual writings. I'm sure if you dug into historical literature, you would find plenty of examples of what we would now call today anterograde or retrograde amnesia. But we were kind of codifying it about 100, almost 140 years ago at this point. Yeah. So this affects predominantly two types of memory. So if you're learning about cognitive psych this semester, you should hopefully by the end of the semester know what declarative and procedural memory are. And this is typically what we see affected. Declarative memory being more facts and events. So if it's events of the person's life, if they forget who was the president when they were growing up, if they forget basic historical information that they learned in school, and then procedural memory. So it's how to perform activities, so how to ride a bike, how to drive a car, how to tie their shoes. And it does seem that when this is portrayed, it's not really mutually exclusive, that it's one or the other. Usually it's like, I could still walk around and the person in the soap opera can still dress themselves in their impeccable suits, but they just can't remember who their wife is. Usually it's broader than this. It's not going to be as selective, because if we're talking about as a result of something like a stroke or a seizure or trauma, that's affecting wide swaths of the brain. And so it's not going to be as like, well, I just forgot how to tie my shoes, but I remembered everything else. If I had to say one movie that does do this well, and I'm going to make the argument for this, it's Muppets Take Manhattan. There is a scene in that movie, and there's no actual trauma involved, but maybe this is also a fugue, because I think this might also be dissociative, like, state. Or dissociative amnesia. So it's more psychologically tied. But in that, Kermit the Frog's, like, freaking out because they're trying to sell this Broadway show, and he walks out in the street, and a car stops right in front of him, and he, like, passes out. And he wakes up, and he cannot remember anything in terms of his past, but he still remembers like how to tie his shoes. All the procedural stuff is there, and that's actually far more common with something like dissociative amnesia as opposed to retrograde or anterograde amnesia, where you're losing the memory or the access to those memories. It's blocked in some way psychologically, but there's no actual trauma involved, and so. Still not retrograde amnesia to the full extent, but that's probably the best dissociative amnesia movie. movie reviews. Watch The Majestic. Watch Muppets Take Manhattan. Watch Muppets Take Manhattan at the very least.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
When we talk about retrograde amnesia, are we talking about the loss of a memory, the blocking of a memory, or the loss of the cues to access the memory?
Yes, I think that's the answer. A lot of this is far more in the realm of like neurological research or medical science as opposed to psychological science, unless we're talking about like a dissociative amnesia state or something within like the neuroscience literature that kind of overlaps with the medical literature. But I think it really depends on what the cause is. If it's head trauma, it's probably, it's not just blocked, it could be destroyed.
I think a lot of it too is going to also be associated with like just retrieval deficits, like the inability to retrieve the information, even though, you know, the neurons are potentially still there. Certain forms of brain damage or, you know, disorders could prevent the person from being able to retrieve the already encoded information that's still, you know, existing in their neural pathways or neural, you know, systems of information.
It's kind of like the neurons are still firing, but the neurons that take those fires, what fires and sends it to the, you know, the other part of our brain that becomes aware of that could be damaged.
Yeah, there's all sorts of, I think, channels or pathways that if there's damage to those and the neurons are still firing, like Daniel's talking about, there's no chance of the brain structures being able to talk to each other. So the memories don't actually, you know, do the beneficial things that they usually do for our ability to interact with the world.
So basically, functionally, it doesn't necessarily matter, but depending on the cause, it could be the loss of the memory or the loss of the cue or the loss of the pathway. But they all look the same to us because the result is no memory.
Yeah, just no memory for past events.
Okay.
Yeah. There's an interesting article I came across where they break down four case studies, and the case studies are presented in chronological order to kind of explain how we actually study and diagnose retrograde amnesia over the years. So like the first is more like simple recall recognition. And then like as time has come along, has gone along, we realize that it's kind of led us to more like complex ways to test it. Like everything from like early studies where they would just give people a list and say, do any of these words sound familiar? And like it was a British case study. So they asked them things like, do you know what Thatcherism is? And if you grew up during, you know, Margaret Thatcher's, you know, tenure as prime minister, there's no way you don't know what that is. And so it would be like asking someone, you know, asking anyone in kind of like, you know, the boomer generation, like what Reaganism is.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, you know, Reaganomics. Like they should be able to at least recognize that word as a thing. And if someone was like, I don't remember that word. And they're like, you were obviously alive during, you know, and an adult during Reagan's presidency, you should know what that is. But they say here that amnesia for people depends not only on how it's tested, but also who is being remembered. Retrograde amnesia can no longer be viewed as a global, all-encompassing deficit, apart from the major dissociation between episodic and semantic memory. We now have evidence that two further dissociations within the domain of episodic memory. I think they're talking here about declarative and procedural, between people and events had been documented in one patient, this person, RFR, and the dissociation between personal and public events in a case study of PS. And so what they're saying is that one, they can actually learn, we can learn more about like the structure of memory by examining people who have impairments, especially when individuals with retrograde amnesia have these sort of odd distinctions where they might remember personal stuff, but forget more public stuff, or remember the public stuff, but forget the personal stuff, depending on where the damage is and what's going on. So that kind of touches on the, like, yes, it could be any of those and all of the above as these sort of different things.
Interesting.
So the two other big, I guess, talking points I found with retrograde amnesia that I find really fascinating. I'll save the first one for the end because I think it's maybe the most controversial because it is something we still do in psychology, but we don't do to the extent anymore. But there was one article I found that talked about this link between anterograde and retrograde amnesia and found that, you know, there's a number of articles going back to the 60s and 70s that look at this like occurrence together. The severity of anterograde amnesia is usually correlated with the severity of retrograde amnesia. And that, again, is backed up by research going back decades. They say it's also true, and like they're at least claiming fact in their study or their review, that retrograde amnesia can sometimes appear disproportionately severe in comparison to anterograde. And there's way too many articles to list off that they cite here. But also anterograde can sometimes occur in the absence of retrograde. So I think what they're arguing here is that anterograde amnesia can occur on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But when retrograde amnesia occurs, we typically also see anterograde amnesia.
Mm. I mean, that would make sense because if you can't remember past events, then everything that's constantly happening to you is a past event.
At least eventually it becomes a past event.
Yeah.
Like maybe you could remember it right after, you know, or shortly after you learn the information, but eventually it's going to turn into information that would, you know, be a past event. But I don't know. It's interesting stuff because aren't there just like 51st states? Well, no, that's the opposite. Aren't there cases where, let's see, people can remember, I don't know, maybe there aren't that many cases, like new information that they come into contact with. But does that ever really truly become consolidated or encoded into like deep long-term memory? I'm not sure. And so you would eventually forget it.
Part of it might be whatever pathways they're connected on. And so if you could like work with a patient and help them maybe, I mean, they're not consciously putting it in a new area of the mind, but thinking about it a different way, it may come back to them easier than if they're kind of storing it in traditional pathways, which have been damaged. It does definitely say that the variations in the expressions of AA and RA, antero and retrograde, heavily depend on the locus and the extent of brain injury. So when we're talking about trauma specifically, we tend to see both. Now, this can be different if we're looking at some other more like psychosomatic effect or psychogenic effect. They also note that like they can even look back. This is something that's been studied for a while. There were these researchers, Russell and Nathan, 1946, that studied, that carried out and showed this comprehensive relationship almost, you know, 80 years ago on 1,000 patients with sustained closed head injury. And so this has been something within at least the medical literature and specifically with trauma. Physical trauma that there's definitely this association, which to me, I guess that makes sense. Cause if you've got the physical trauma, it's probably, you know, and you're disrupting some of the brain pathways associated with memory, it should affect whatever direction that information's flowing or whatever, you know, if that area is associated with memory, it should affect both like storage and retrieval, unless those are happening in two completely different systems.
Mm-hmm. But you would need both of them to be interrelated so that way they could work fluidly. So,
yeah. It's probably the most interesting thing I've come across just because it was very like, okay, wait, they're related. And then typically, I mean, this is not my forte in terms of research or anything I'm like super comfortable usually talking about because of expertise that, it's just really fascinating to kind of delve into some of this literature. Where I am a little, at least more knowledgeable, is with increases in retrograde amnesia as a result of electroconvulsive therapy.
Ah.
And there is some new research out there looking at new, like, magnetic resonance based. I think it's a magnetic resonance treatment for depression, as opposed to the electroconvulsive therapy, which if it sounds like shock therapy, it's because it is. It's just not as
grotesque.
Yeah, yeah. They usually have people sedated. They send a small electric shock into the temple and it causes a seizure. Because the person's sedated, they don't move around a lot, but the seizure causes a flood of neurotransmitters. And seizures, seizures flooding the brain with serotonin and other neurotransmitters actually goes back in the medical literature to like Hippocrates.
Interesting.
Like to the Greeks, and noticing that like people who would get like malaria and have high fever induced seizures would suddenly not have like their psychological symptoms anymore afterwards. And that's why like electroconvulsive therapy or electroshock therapy kind of came in vogue, because it had a basis, but we've heavily made sure that it is far more safe. It's only used as a last resort nowadays, but even when it is used, that's the big side effect. That's one of the big side effects to worry about is memory loss.
Hmm. See, when you said psych was still doing this thing, I was thinking you were going to say lobotomy.
No.
No, but lobotomy. Electroshock therapy. I was like, well, yeah, lobotomy would make you lose your memory.
So they do. It's called what is it called? It's not I wanted to say electroencephalogram, but that's not it. It's called bilateral cingulotomy is one of the types, but basically the way that a modern version, like a humane version of the lobotomy works now, is that they put like a like monofilament electrode into your brain, and they like just the tip like cauterizes like almost like pinpoint areas, and so they're super specific. And again, like only maybe a dozen of these procedures, and we're talking like out of 350 million Americans, are ever done in America each year. It's last resort kind of stuff. It's like nothing else is working. This person can't stop having seizures. Like we need to go and like just disrupt these very small connections in like certain areas of their brain. Where the lobotomy was just like, we're just going to stick an ice pick up there or an ice pick like device and just, you forget
see
everything.
What happens.
Yep.
There is something I've learned this semester. There is now a new stage before electroshock therapy for things like depression. They are now doing ketamine nasal sprays.
Oh, interesting.
I've heard about that. Yeah, I've heard about that.
Mm-hmm. So like at high doses, ketamine will act as a sedative, but at low doses, it's a stimulant. Mm-hmm. For serotonin neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm. That's good. There's also a step past electroconvulsive therapy, and it's kind of like a pacemaker
for your brain.
It like sends a mild electric pulse every, I don't know, couple of days or something like that, and it basically causes a flood of neurotransmitters.
It's really interesting.
Huh.
And it's kind of scary.
A little bit. Yes. No. I don't know how I'd ever feel about having one of those, but you know, I mean, but at that point we're talking about real severe cases where like nothing else has worked. So, but the downside is if you're sending electric shocks into the brain, can cause memory loss. And they're trying to, one of the studies they came across was trying an alternative way to kind of release these neurotransmitters and try to avoid the memory loss, the retrograde amnesia associated with it. Like it could be temporary still, but like that's, it's not really a side effect you want.
Children, pray the SSRIs work.
Yeah. Give them their 4 to 8 weeks, you know, try a couple of different types. If they don't work, you know, get the dosage up. Like
go to a shopping for a therapist.
Yes.
Don't just see one. Find one that fits.
Try meditation. Try everything else.
Try anything.
Get a cat. Get a dog. Get anything. Like
paint your walls yellow. I don't care.
Right.
Yeah. That would be the only, because that's kind of the alternative. But yeah, yeah. So I mean, we have this kind of connection, at least amongst trauma. But you guys aren't going to talk about trauma.
No.
No.
Or at least, I mean, maybe by proxy, if we're talking about.
I mean, the seizures are a good bridge for me.
Yeah. So you guys are going to talk about drug use and other things.
And other things. Yeah. No, I think ours are particularly pertain to anterograde amnesia. And so, like, definitely. Both short-term anterograde amnesia and then, like, very abrupt, possibly fatal anterograde amnesia. So I'll let you, Alyssa, go first, since it's a little bit more lighthearted.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about specifically a class of drugs called benzodiazepines. People sometimes refer to them as benzos, but they're a type of psychoactive drug that is usually treated, they're usually used for the treatment of like panic disorders, acute panic disorders. They are usually prescribed to treat anxiety and insomnia and sometimes even seizures, because what it does is it calms down the firing of neurons very quickly. So some common benzodiazepines that people are probably familiar with would be medications such as Xanax or Ativan or Klonopin.
Klonopin,
yeah. But if you have ever been prescribed one of these drugs or if you've ever taken one of these drugs, what you may recognize as being characteristic of them is that they cause a form of anterograde amnesia, or, you know, they cause memory loss after you've taken the drug. And I'm also going to talk about why that occurs within the context of alcohol as well, because both alcohol and benzodiazepines seem to lead to memory loss or amnesia for the same reasons. And I apologize for my sniffling. I've been sick for so long and I'm trying to suppress it, but I might sniffle here and there as I'm trying to talk about some of this stuff. But before I like get into why benzodiazepines and alcohol cause, you know, amnesia, it's important to talk about this question that's been prevalent in the field of cognitive psychology, but also neuropsychology, probably neuroscience as a whole. And that is, you know, why does forgetting occur? Is it due to some form of interference, which I'll get into in just a second, or is it due to just natural decay of memory? For those of y'all who don't know what decay is, it's just this idea that as we get older, our brain is going to degrade in the sense that it's going to, you know, slowly lose its cognitive functions. And in that process, you also are going to have the decay of memories where you start to slowly lose your memories over time and also your memory performance. And researchers have definitely, you know, supported that interference and decay are both at play in terms of our slow degrade of memory over time. But what I have learned from some of the work that I've read in the past couple of days is that it actually seems to be maybe a little bit more due to interference effects that lead to memory loss. One way that researchers have tried to determine, you know, if it's more decay related or interference related is to try to come up with an experiment where the learning phase is followed by a retention phase. So what I mean by that is, you know, the time period in between learning and retrieval, but followed by a retention phase where the brain of the subject is biologically active, where it will allow for natural decay processes to keep unfolding. But in correspondence with that, it would be nice to be able to have cases where the brain is also incapable of learning new information so that the new information doesn't interfere with prior learning. There's two different types of interference, which would be what I am referring to as, you know, new learning interfering with prior learning, for instance. We call them proactive interference and retroactive interference. Proactive interference is where the old information that you have already learned in your life interferes with new information that you're trying to learn. And then in contrast to that, retrograde interference is where new information inhibits you from remembering old information. And what they did in a couple studies is they tried to determine whether, you know, it's interference or more decay that's going on with forgetting. So they had subjects study lists of words where half of them went to sleep right after they studied the list and the other half remained awake for the rest of the day. And they found that the people who went to sleep had less memory loss for the information, which may be due to the fact that they did not have to deal with interference effects. The people who went to sleep didn't encounter any new information because they were asleep. So the information that they encoded right before they went to sleep was able to be consolidated and later remembered better than people who encountered new information, which interfered with the stuff that they learned that they were going to be tested on. And some researchers suggested that most of our memory loss was due to proactive interference. So again, what that means is old information is affecting the learning of new information. But over time and recently, they have been able to show that there's actually this effect may be more due to the importance of retroactive interference and how cases or conditions where retroactive interference is reduced, that leads to enhancement of memory for the information that you learned prior to conditions where retroactive interference was reduced. And one example of a condition where that occurs is during sleep. While you sleep, again, you're not interacting with new information. So nothing is capable of interfering with the stuff that you learned right before you went to sleep or, you know, in the hours before you went to sleep. And all of this is related to benzodiazepines and alcohol and in a way because it's all about how your hippocampus, which is the part of our brain that is associated with where we store our long-term memories. There's a process called long-term potentiation that goes on where neurons are activated and fired more so, or there's an enhancement of firing. And that's a process that leads to memory consolidation or, you know, true like deep encoding of memories into the long-term memory system. And if you are asleep, like I said, there's not any kind of interference from new information, but the stuff that you were studying right before you went to sleep or things that you were encoding right before you went to sleep, while you're sleeping, that long-term potentiation process is going on, neurons are firing, specifically mostly during REM sleep, and you're able to consolidate the information from that day that you encountered, but you don't really tend to encode information that your brain is working on while you're sleeping. This is also related to like why we tend to remember dreams that occur during REM sleep. And that's because long-term potentiation is going on during REM sleep, while other stages of sleep reduce, you know, the incoming information that your brain is working on. It's not getting input into the hippocampus, basically, which is where, you know, long-term memories are stored. And so I'm sure most of you are very much so aware or have experienced, you know, blackout effects or, you know, a case of blackouts after you've partake in or partook, I don't know what the right word is, after you have drank a high level of alcohol, even if you haven't, you know, used some of the benzodiazepine class of drugs, the same, like I said at the beginning, the same type of effects can occur for just regular alcohol intake. And what goes on is that you actually will see what researchers call retrograde facilitation, where recently formed memories are actually retained better than they would otherwise when you have taken in a high level of alcohol or a benzodiazepine. So it is actually kind of interesting, like the memories that you form right before you drink a high level of alcohol or right before you take a benzodiazepine, those memories are actually strengthened by the condition of you taking those substances into your body. And that's because they are inhibiting new information from being input into your hippocampus, more so potentially than normal cases of like sleeping, which I think would also be associated with benzodiazepines and alcohol not allowing you to fall into like REM sleep, or it keeps you pretty deep in those, you know, levels of sleep where you're really not bringing in any new information. Even when you're still conscious on, you know, alcohol or benzodiazepines, you're not bringing in new information. There's no new input. And so there's nothing that's going to compete with the information that you were taking in right before you intook the, you know, drugs or the substances. I want to go on the record
and say we do not endorse alcohol or benzodiazepines as a study aid.
Right, that's exactly what I was about to say. I was going to say this doesn't mean that you should, you know, study and then take a drink a bunch of alcohol right after you study. Don't take your benzodiazepines, especially like Xanax, like right after you study, thinking that that's going to help you remember the information the next day.
Not that my Korean professor was a medical doctor or cognitive psychologist, but he did actually encourage us to drink while we practiced Korean.
Really?
Yeah. He was like, you'll be less nervous. It'll cut you down. You won't think about it anymore. You'll just do it. And I was like, oh, okay. Can we drink in class?
I would say that is definitely poor advice, because from based on what I read, as soon as you start intaking the thing, you're not going to be able to study while you're doing it, or you think you are, but that information is not going to reach your long-term memory.
Is that even like in small amounts? Cause like you, when you say like, you know, a person's experience of like blacking out, like I have never had that. I've never imbibed enough alcohol.
You haven't gotten white girl wasted before, Daniel.
the closest I ever gotten was the day of my wedding. I think I knocked off like a bottle of champagne myself. I was still pretty high functioning. Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes a lot. I'm a big guy, so it takes more for me.
Yeah. See,
I guess the same with caffeine. I could drink in high school. I used to drink like, you know, I could drink a 12 pack of Coke and be like, I'm fine. I'm going to bed now. So maybe it's just tolerance. I don't drink that much caffeine anymore.
Yeah, no. So I don't know if I know the full answer to your question, but I would say based on what I read that it does depend on the amount, specifically with alcohol and tolerance levels.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of benzodiazepines, I think that the drug is meant to sedate you in a similar way that sleep would. And it does it pretty quickly. And I did read something too that, you know, this effect of the lack of input after you take the drug is also associated with how quickly the sedation effects arise. So a benzodiazepine pretty much will almost always lead to that reduction in the retroactive interference, or, you know, the input of new information affecting old information. But when it comes to alcohol, I don't think that's the case. I think that you have to drink enough to the point where you're going to hit that blackout level, because I mean, people who do remember, you know, times where they've, you know, blacked out, usually they remember everything up until the moment that they blacked out. And once they reach that threshold, whatever causes that threshold, you know, it's going to be varied across individuals and obviously probably the alcohol mm-hmm. they're drinking. That threshold is where, you know, they get sedated so much that the memory formation of new information does not occur anymore. Long-term potentiation is not going to be possible for any kind of new information. But for some reason, based on what I read, alcohol and benzodiazepines still allow long-term potentiation of information that occurred before you got to that threshold or before you took the benzodiazepine.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, because you're not taking... I mean, I guess if someone wanted to, they could take like half a Xanax or a quarter of a Xanax, but they're not... The people who are going to take a Xanax are going to take a Xanax. And someone might sip on a beer, and that's very different just because of what their core intended purpose is.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting stuff, and it's hard to fully understand, honestly, coming from a, you know, more empirical-based cognitive background, because the stuff, you know, with long-term potentiation is very neuro-based. It's the neuropsychologists, the neuroscientists that do this kind of research. Like, literally, the definition of long-term potentiation is that it is a long-lasting enhancement of synaptic transmission in response to brief, high-frequency stimulation of presynaptic neurons. So it's really hard to, like, really understand, other than, like, I think what it means is that there's an increase of firing in the neurons that are going mm-hmm. to be associated with the hippocampus, which we have determined is associated with long-term memories. But it's hard stuff, and I mean, I'm sure that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in a neural, you know, area of research with cognitive function.
Yeah, and this is definitely not something you can ethically bring a bunch of people into a lab and say, all right, we're going to give you a bunch of benzos.
Right, right.
We're going to let you black out and see what happens.
I was going to ask, are all benzos created equally? Because I know some of them are like fast acting for specifically like panic attacks, like Xanax is like really good about initiating immediately. Whereas like a Klonopin will take a long time for it to actually like kick in. So I was going to look it up. I haven't been able to find anything, but from what I understand, like the risk of overdose on like a Xanax is higher than a Klonopin, unless you're like actually abusing it, because of this idea that anterograde amnesia is like you're not remembering that you already took the drug.
Right. So I don't actually know the right answer, or what the real answer is there. But I would say that's probably due to how intense or how strong of a drug the person needs. So like you said, Xanax is usually typically the most intense out of the class of drugs, meaning that it works the fastest and is, I think, the strongest. But Ativan and Klonopin, for instance, they still work very fast. They're just not as intense as Xanax. But they all are, what they're doing is they're enhancing the effect of the neurotransmitter called GABA. Which is associated with our, you know, wakefulness, our arousal levels. And so if they enhance the amount of GABA that's in our brain, which is what these drugs are doing, it results in us falling asleep, becoming calm in terms of our muscles become relaxed. It also is an anticonvulsant, so that's why they can be used to treat seizures. It'll stop the firing of the neurons, so that, you know, that is what a seizure is. I think it's like all the neurons are like, there's a big level of firing of neurons that aren't necessarily supposed to be firing right at that moment. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I do, from what I understand, think that Xanax is the strongest one, but I don't know why that is or how they actually decided to prescribe one versus the other.
We need to have a psychopharmacologist on.
Yeah. I don't think that they use like Xanax for, you know, like seizure treatment though. For instance, I think Xanax is more
for... Usually I associate with like panic disorder.
Anti-anxiety, like... yeah. Like immediate need for relief before you have a panic attack. But they do use like Ativan, for instance, a lot in like hospitals or in terms of seizures, to prevent seizures. So I don't know. That's a good question. I'm sure somebody knows. I'm sure many people know.
Cool. Yeah.
I will say that GABA is my favorite neurotransmitter to say.
Oh, yeah.
I also like telling my students what it stands for and giving them that brief moment of, is that going to be on the test?
They better sleep on it.
And then I'm like, no, no, you don't have to know
what it actually stands. What does it stand for? Gamma aminobutyric acid. Aminobutyric, right. That's the part that I struggle with, the aminobutyric. Yeah, I have trouble even saying norepinephrine. I think I said it right that time. Mm-hmm. Norepinephrine. Yeah. I have to say it fast so I don't get stuck as I'm like saying it. But yeah, neurotransmitters are cool. I think it's super cool the way that we figured out, you know, how to enhance the amount that's in the brain at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
We should do neurotransmitters in an episode. We have not done that.
That would be cool.
It would be cool. We could talk about dopamine, which is a fun one, and
oxytocin.
I think that's they even consider certain natural cannabinoids that we have in our brain as being neurotransmitters. They're not like one of the main ones, but I have read that there are these neurotransmitter like neurons in our brain that are similar to cannabinoids that you would find in THC, for instance.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I know there's the obvious like opioid. Mm-hmm. But that's interesting.
Cool.
Yeah. But that's what I learned, and it's hard stuff to understand, but yeah, definitely don't use these substances if you're trying to enhance your memory. But they have found evidence that, you know, memory for stuff right before you take the substance is still able to be learned, and even more so it is enhanced mostly because of the lack of input of new information that follows the ingestion.
Well, we can look at the silver lining of this is that what we can tell people, if you do think that it's going to be a really good idea to go binge drink and get like really wasted, you are going to remember everything up until then. And it is going to be a far more intense memory, at least based on what the research says.
Yes.
Now, beyond that point, nothing. But up until that point, you're going to remember. And it may not be something you want to remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
Moderation and everything.
Yes. So for my bit, I wanted to look at anterograde amnesia. Like, what are the other causes? Because, you know, as we discussed, benzos, alcohol, blunt force brain trauma are the most common like context in which we learn about amnesia. And so typically there's like this throwaway comment like, oh, and some illnesses can cause amnesia as well. And so I went hunting for illnesses, and I found myself back in my wheelhouse with herpes simplex.
Some illness.
And it was honestly the most fascinating and horrifying dive I've taken in this podcast, I think. So there's a condition called herpes simplex encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain. It happens to 1 in 500,000 people. And this particular encephalitis is a rapid onset, rapid decline, high mortality rate kind of disease. And it's caused by either herpes simplex virus 1 or herpes simplex virus 2. And there are hundreds of herpes viruses, but there's only about 10 that affect humans. And simplex 1 are what we usually think of as like cold sores around the mouth. And herpes simplex 2 is the genital cold sores that we associate as like an STI or, yeah, an STD. It's not an infection, it's a disease. Now, to be clear, before I like frighten anyone, the cold sores are the external cold sores on the lips and face. They're not the internal canker sores that we get. So the internal canker sores can be caused by a strain of herpes that's not transmittable. It could also be stress. It could also be diet. It could be salts. If you're a smoker who's trying to quit smoking, you can start getting them. If you bump the wrong food at the wrong place at the wrong time on your gums, you can get one of these. So it's not those sores I'm referring to. It's the ones that show up around the mouth in waves. And so you have outbreaks of herpes. So you'll go, you know, a period of time with no sores, and then you'll go a period of time with sores. And typically as you age, these sores, both for simplex one and two, the waiting period between the outbreaks gets longer and longer and longer. And so when you're younger, it can be rather rapid and violent. And when you're older, it tends to even itself out and you spend more time not having outbreaks than you do have outbreaks. And you can only pass herpes simplex if you are having an outbreak. So if you're in a gestating period, then you don't have to worry about it. So about 54 to 57% of Americans have simplex one. So the mouth, the oral cold sores. And this is the number one cause of herpes simplex encephalitis. And the main theory right now, because we don't really know what happens, but the current theory is that the cold sore, when you go into an outbreak, will travel, the virus will travel up an olfactory nerve and into the brain, and then it will travel from one temporal lobe to the other, and then the prefrontal cortex will get hit, or the frontal lobe will get hit, and then the limbic system will get hit after that. And so this will cause, obviously, anterograde amnesia at least it will cause that. And so, and I was doing some reading that it does happen with prenatal and infants as well. But that one is usually due to simplex virus 2, the genital herpes. So if you're born with genital herpes, then if you're having an outbreak, you can get it that way at a very young age. But it only accounts for 10% of the causes of the encephalitis in adults. So 90% is from the oral. So that's horrifying. That's more than like half Americans.
I went and did the math. That's about, like, if we're just talking about like 350 million Americans, about 700 people, I guess, a year, and 70 for that one cause. That's 10%.
Yeah.
So it's very rare in the grand scheme of things. But
Now the mortality rate is 70%. And so the number one cause, I was like trying to figure out why. And so obviously we have a virus that's attacking and causing inflammation of several parts of the brain that are super important. But the reason why it has such a high mortality rate is that it's usually caught too late. By the time somebody starts having symptoms and goes to a hospital, because the symptoms can look like seizures, but they're not seizures. They can also be fever, vomiting, diarrhea, a whole host of physiological symptoms. But also there are behavioral, personality, and affective distortions as well. And so one of the most common misdiagnoses that people go to the hospital who start experiencing this receive is schizophrenia. And that will delay treatment. And so typically what happens is that you have to go through a spinal tap, and then you will receive treatment based off of the preliminary evidence, which can take about 6 to 7 hours, but it will take 10 days to confirm that that's what you have. And the treatment is pretty homogenous. It's acyclovir, which is the medication that's administered through IV. And there's actually a guideline for acyclovir that care providers can administer it on suspicion of encephalitis. So they don't need confirmation from tests in order to administer it. But because it's up to individual surgeons and doctors to determine that there is suspect enough for them to give this medication, that's also the second problem, is that they get misdiagnosed, and then second, the surgeon or physician or whomever does not feel comfortable with the level of suspicion and relies solely on the preliminary evidence from the spinal tap in order to deliver the medication.
And so they have 10 days, like, even if they suspect it, they have 10 days to wait for a diagnosis. And so what's too long? How many days?
So they can get the preliminary results in 7 okay. hours. And that's usually when they will administer okay. acyclovir. But those 7 hours are crucial because the inflammation is destroying these parts of the brain. And so only about 5% of patients, from what I'm reading, come away unscathed with psychological disorders. And obviously, anterograde amnesia is prime in this because it's attacking the limbic system where the hippocampus is. And so that is the major problem, is that it's individual biases. And I found several analyses of when people end up getting medication and the relationship between severity of outcomes, and it does not look great. I think the worst factors are if you're under the age of, let's see, is this the one? Yes, factors associated. Let's see. Well, I thought that was it. Uno momento, por favor. Let's see. Okay, so 45.9% of patients experience at least one missed opportunity for diagnosis. And then, let's see, 21.9% of these patients had delays lasting more than 7 days. And the risk factors for delays include being only seen in an emergency department, being younger than 65, or having a history of schizophrenia or alcohol abuse.
They're just going to play it off, or misdiagnose it as one of those.
Yeah, they're going to misdiagnose it as more common things. Mm-hmm. And so afterwards, the symptoms during the process, fever, strokes, decrease in consciousness, you have major personality shifts as well, which leads to the schizophrenia issue. Altered mental states, confusion, and then post, you can have a range of any sort of disability associated with neurological damage, along with anterograde amnesia, or with full-on dissociation after the fact. Let's see. So that is one of the prime diseases that can cause anterograde amnesia that's not necessarily related to blunt force trauma, but it is still a brain inflammation issue.
It's crazy stuff.
And right?
Like, it can happen so fast. And so what I'm trying to understand from what you were saying, I understand most of it, but like, so people who have herpes simplex, either 1 or 2, primarily 1, which is oral, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody who has that is at risk of this and inflammation of the brain.
Yep.
Oh, okay. That's really scary because of also, you know, how common that it, herpes simplex is. So it kind of makes me feel.
Oh yeah. No, the rates are like 54 to 57% of Americans have simplex 1.
Right. So if they're on the, like the drugs that they can get prescribed to reduce outbreaks, is that going to reduce their chances of developing it? Because didn't you say that they have to be having an outbreak for it to lead to encephalitis?
Okay. Yeah. So if they have an outbreak suppressant, and they don't develop an outbreak, or I guess even a minor outbreak, but also one of the things I noticed is that acyclovir is administered through IV as treatment for this, but also you can get acyclovir in a lotion for herpes treatment, like by yourself.
Interesting.
So you can get prescribed this as a lotion or as an oral or as a spray. And so I'm wondering if you're actively using this or perhaps a outbreak suppressant, if then that reduces your risk.
Be interesting to look at like this over time. So like as this drug has become more widely available, have you seen cases go down? And if that would be a little correlation into to maybe that has something to do with it. It is also, I mean, again, very rare, but its symptoms are also very, like, it makes sense to me too that why you'd be at risk if you're under 65, because it's those symptoms are probably far more severe if you're an older person than if you're younger. If you're younger and like, oh, you know, I've got flu-like symptoms, I'm just going to stay home and like ride it out. And it turns out it's much more severe.
Yeah, if you're like a mid-20s dude with it, you're like, oh, shoot, I'm coming down with schizophrenia.
Right, right. just more.
One note that I did find is that this drug has been in use since the 1980s, but we've known about herpes and syphilitis since the Greeks.
Interesting.
And so it's been with us for a very, very long time.
This seems like another case for educating people on herpes simplex.
Mm-hmm. You know,
another reason why people should be talking about it rather than, you know, being embarrassed by the fact that a lot of people have different types of herpes. And I know the people who, you know, a lot of people who have it, I'm sure know that they have it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they know the risks that come along with having it as well as they maybe should.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't have a choice in it too. A lot of people are born with herpes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And like, I mean, especially oral herpes, I mean, really any of it, like it's so easy for anybody to pick it up and not even realize that they have it for forever or even the longest time, like a long time before they, you know, have a full-blown outbreak. There's a lot of people
who have it and don't refer to it as such or recognize it as such because of potential stigma that's associated with herpes when it's so common with just cold sores.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And it needs to be, that's like a huge thing for me is I think it needs to be talked about more because it's not as, you know, it's terrible, but it's not necessarily as bad as people have made it out to be because so many of us have it. And
yep. Now, I just thought it was interesting that it was the oral simplex one that was associated with this and not simplex two. Because usually, like with simplex two, that's where you get lots of stigma.
Yeah, definitely. Because it's a sexually transmittable thing. I think that's where the stigma comes from. But it makes sense to me that that's the one that causes it. Because what did you say? It's because it goes through the olfactory.
That's the leading hypothesis right now. Yeah.
That would make sense. I mean, it's so close to the brain too. Like it's going to enter the olfactory system, like right there and reach the brain. I think I would say easier than from, you know, the base of your spine, which I think is where simplex two is located usually or contained as the base of your spine.
It's just more existential dread from the cognitive season.
Yay. Anyway.
I guess this would be a good spot to lead us into our bias of the week.
Woohoo!
Because I figured like this actually works out really well because if we're talking about illnesses, we're talking about amnesia, and you've listened to this, you may next time you're like not feeling so great, might be the flu. It might pop into your head that maybe this is something else. And you probably don't have that to worry about, but that ability for it to pop into your head is our bias of the week, brought to you by Kahneman and Tversky. 1973, as well as many of the others. It's availability heuristic. So our tendency to overestimate the likelihood of events with greater availability in memory. So the more you think about it, the more you focus on it, the more you've recently heard it or it's been primed, the more it's important to you in some meaningful way, the more likely it is to pop into your head. And so you might overestimate those events, which can be influenced by how recent the memories are and how unusual or emotionally charged they may be.
Huh. I mean, that's probably part of the reason with the reason in syphilitis not getting diagnosed is that ER doctors see strokes every day, I'm sure.
Yeah, you're far more likely statistically to see schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so there's a case that came to Oh man, I forget the name of the illness, but there was a doctor who, after several misdiagnoses, properly diagnosed. It was like intermittent porphyria. It's basically that like vampirism illness where like you have severe susceptibility to sunlight. It's like issues with I think certain vitamins or minerals in the blood. But it's the doctor properly diagnosed it in this case because he had just written a book on medieval illnesses in royalty, and it was especially prone in royalty that intermarried.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that that was like, I know of the illness or the, what is it called, a disease or an illness?
I think it's a disease. Like it's, or a it's disease. An it's an illness, or you know, maybe an illness that develops. Or it might be a genetic illness. So illness might be right. More appropriate, because it's not passed on.
Right.
But it, because it's genetic, it would transfer amongst, let's say, interbreeding royals in the Middle Ages. But in this case, passed on and exhibited in this patient. And there are just dozens upon dozens of cases of this happening. I would imagine that at the beginning of the pandemic, there were a lot of flu diagnoses because someone comes in and the doctor's like, "Hey, you got the flu. You got this thing that's going on." Mm-hmm. When it's something far more serious because it has similar symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of dependent on what we think or what is on our mind or what we're used to seeing. What's the availability of it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can also think about people like even myself who develop a cough and immediately I have COVID.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's the most available thing going on right now. But I also have non-allergic rhinitis, which means that I get severe sinus infections that often turn into upper respiratory infections like every single year. But because I was quarantined for a year, you know, and still I'm not going out too much, I didn't really get sick for a year and a half, like at all.
Yeah.
But the more available information is COVID. So as soon as I actually got hit again with a sinus infection, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's COVID. It's definitely COVID. When
mm-hmm.
normally I get these sinus infections all the time, but they haven't been around lately.
Yeah, you're back in the classroom.
Yeah, it's killing.
Did it.
Oh, I'm ready. Like, I just know, because like you, like I get strep throat every year, and I know this February, it's going down.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That sounds terrible.
And last time I got it was at SPSP, and it was like a super rare international strep throat.
I
didn't show up on the strep throat tests that they give you. We had to do a full scan.
I got an upper respiratory infection after that SPSP.
Yep. That was the Georgia one, right?
No. Oh no. I got not the Georgia one. I got a sinus infection after the New Orleans one, and that was it was February 2020. So I was really concerned. I was debating with myself whether or not I maybe actually caught COVID in New Orleans because it was going around at that time. They've tracked it. And I was like, in retrospect, I know how bad sinus infections are. So it was definitely a sinus infection in retrospect.
Thankfully, I skipped that one and I was with the furries who are always social distancing due to their fursuits.
They're always wearing masks.
Man, those group gatherings of all types, I get sick after music festivals because I'm in a crowd of people constantly on top of the dust that gets all up in your nose. But it's something that is definitely a real thing.
So we are boiling down to the end of this, but Chomsky watch?
I do not have a Chomsky forecast.
No word next from week so Chomsky. So.
No word from Chomsky yet.
All right, we are getting.
I should probably keep an eye out on my spam, though.
Yeah. Possible. We'll never know.
I guess we'll find out on Thursday.
Yeah, I guess we will. So, yeah, good talk. This is a heavier one. I might have to put a little warning or a little tag on our description. It's a little heavier conversation.
We should call this one "Children Pray the SSRIs Work."
Oh,
oh my gosh.
I I was going to call it sex, drugs, and retrograde amnesia.
Oh.
So. I think that's a safer one.
Yeah. So, on that note, we'll say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.